This is the United States Dressage Federation's official podcast. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Chris Stafford. On this week's show, Dr. Victoria Maxwell begins a two-part series on degenerative joint disease in the performance horse. But before that, Alison Head has our trainers segment this week in which she addresses dressage seat equitation. Alison is the owner of Looking Glass Farm in Hamilton, Virginia. She is also a USEF R judge, a member of the USEF Dressage Committee, and chair of the Dressage Seat Equitation Subcommittee. Alison is also a USDF bronze, silver, and gold medalist, an advisor to the USDF Youth Programs Committee, and a former Region 1 regional director. Alison, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And how long have you been involved with this program?
Well, I became a member of the USDF Dressage Committee and became chair of the Dressage Seat Equitation Subcommittee. And so that's how I really got involved with dressage seat equitation, although I have had students participate over the years. I'm just going to tell people a little bit about what dressage seat equitation is, why they might want to consider participating, and what programs and classes USDF and USEF offer that pertain to dressage seat equitation. Dressage seat equitation class evaluates the equitation of the rider as opposed to the performance of the horse. If you think in normal dressage tests, the horse's performance is the primary consideration, with the rider evaluation limited to the score given in the collective marks. So each mark goes through and says how well the horse is performing each movement. Yet we know that the horse's performance and the rider's performance are very closely linked. So the dressage seat equitation classes provide valuable feedback to riders on not so much their horse's performance, but on their seat position and the effectiveness of their aids. They are open to riders of all ages, so adults can participate, young children can participate. They are open to all types of horses and all levels of training. You don't have to have a very fancy horse with great gaits to participate in dressage seat equitation and do well. The quality of the horse's gaits are really not a consideration in a dressage seat equitation class, and the rider is able to show off his or her skills rather than their horse's training. As we know, all equine sports really put a value on good equitation. Hunters, the saddle seat riders, you know, most disciplines offer classes that evaluate a rider's equitation skills. And in dressage, we do the same thing. In dressage, we consider equitation important not only for the security of the rider, to be able to stay on when you need to, but the ability of the rider to positively influence the horse, whether it's in training or in a test situation, and also the unity of the rider. And it comes to mind of just watching the Weg and Vallegro and her tests, and that's, you know, the epitome of good equitation is Charlotte Dujardin and Vallegro. To be effective, the rider needs to have at least a good position, a correct position, and correct weight distribution, and the rider should be able to match the movement of the horse as the horse goes through its various gaits and the various movements. If people are wondering what judges are looking for in position, the dressage rules, specifically DR 117, set out a number of the criteria that judges use to evaluate riders and their equitation, whether it's in a test situation or in a dressage seat equitation class. Dressage seat equitation classes can be offered at any dressage show. They can be at a licensed show, they can be at a schooling show. They're open to riders of all ages, they can be open to adults, they can be grouped by age or by ability. And they're a great way to introduce younger riders to the sport of dressage with an eye toward teaching them the important seat and position skills that will carry them further as they go on in their riding careers. There's no minimum age for competing in dressage seat equitation. And rules for running classes and how they run at the show ring are found also in the dressage rules under DR 133. Classes for dressage seat equitation run similarly to classes in other disciplines. The riders will work as a group, and they'll follow the directions of the judge or the ringmaster. So they might all be asked to trot or, you know, sitting trot, rising trot, as a group. depending on the level of the riders and their security, as well as the size of the arena and the number of riders, the judge may have them canter as a group or divide them into smaller groups for cantering, or even canter them individually. The judge can also ask riders to perform individual tests that contain movements that are suitable to the ability of the riders that the judge sees in front of them in the ring. And in no time will the movements be above basically what's offered in a, or asked for in a first-level test. For novice riders or younger riders, it's also possible to have walk-trot-only equitation classes, and those are offered at some of the shows. And, you know, the tests for those classes, if there are any, would be suitable to a walk-trot rider. And equitation classes can be a lot of fun. A lot of times they'll pin the classes in the ring, a little bit like a hunter class. Every rider gets their own score, so you can kind of evaluate yourself as you go along and to see if you can, you know, over time improve your score in the equitation class. While the score sheets aren't posted, judges do like to come up and make some individual comments to the riders while they're lined up in the ring, and that's often very helpful. We really enjoy being able to talk to the riders and tell them a little bit about what we see in their position and their aids. For the junior riders in equitation, USDF and USEF have developed a jointly run dressage seat medal program. The riders can qualify for the dressage seat medal semifinals, which are held at each of the regional championships in the nine regions. And the top riders from those semifinal classes are invited to the very prestigious dressage seat medal final classes, which are held the following summer. They just were held this past weekend at Lamplight in conjunction with the Young Horse Championships. I've had two students qualify for the finals. It's a very fun program for the kids. A lot of them are also working toward the NAJYRC, the Young Rider classes. So it's a very good program for developing the younger riders as they go along. So why participate in equitation? You know, a lot of my students ask me that, and pros, a lot of times they're hesitant in the beginning. But it's fun. It's different. It's a group class instead of a test by yourself. I think it's a good skill to learn to ride in a group class, which a lot of dressage horses and dressage riders don't do. And you get feedback on how you're doing in your riding rather than just how your horse is showing itself in the ring. As a trainer and a competitor, I know that I try to work on my equitation every day when I ride, and I just, as a golf pro might work to perfect their swing and their stance. And as a judge, I see always that a lot of times position weaknesses and flaws can affect the performance in a test. So I'm a true believer that working on equitation from the very start is really important to dressage.
And you can find an article on equitation, not just for hunt seat riders, in the September issue of Connection magazine. And now for our veterinary segment on degenerative joint disease in the performance horse by Dr. Victoria Maxwell, which was presented in a session at the 2013 Adequan USDF Annual Convention.
One of my biggest goals in my educational format is that I want you to be able to read everything that's coming through the horse, equus, practical horseman, whatever it is that you're getting your hands on. I want you to have a much clearer understanding of what those articles are trying to convey. Everybody in this room has a joint philosophy in your barn. You may not have called it that, but everybody has some idea of how they're going to address joint disease, whether current, progressive, geriatric horses, young stock, whatever it is. And we're going to talk about what those potential therapies include and where your money is best invested in something like this. I'm also here today with my friend John Cashman. John works with us here in Lexington, Kentucky. So when we talk about equine lameness, pretty basic when a lot of sort of people think about it, sort of stresses and strains that take a toll on the horse. I certainly like to be able to get to a lameness a lot earlier in the disease process. The further out that the lameness goes, certainly the body begins to adapt and it starts to make a lot of changes. Those things are a little bit harder to come over. My third component is that I really am, as a scientist and a well-trained scientist, I really like to go with things that have proven, especially things that have gone through the FDA approval process. I think as a veterinarian, if I have an allotment of 20 horses, I need 18 of those horses to respond. There may be two outliers for various reasons that don't do well. But if I'm only getting two out of that 18 to respond, I'm not doing my job. So the repeatability really has to be there for me. So what is degenerative joint disease? It seems kind of a big, long, loose term. It sort of sounds like arthritis, but it doesn't sound like arthritis. So osteoarthritis is really a term that's reserved for human medicine. Degenerative joint disease is really a term that's reserved for veterinary medicine. Because as veterinarians, we borrow so much literature from the human side. We're reading the New England Journal of Medicine, we're reading Science, Nature, Lancet, those sorts of things to try to keep up with cutting edge things. The two terms have become sort of interposed. I have a lot of owners that think osteoarthritis is a more advanced disease than degenerative joint disease, and that's just not the case. They're the same disease. Well, then that leads us into, well, isn't osteoarthritis really a disease of the geriatric? Isn't it a disease of my grandmother? I'm in my mid-50s. I certainly don't have osteoarthritis, in my opinion, even though I'm forcing myself in a midlife crisis to try to do marathons. I'm certainly inducing what's known as repetitive load. And this repetitive load that we put on our athletes leads them in to alterations or remodeling inside of the joint environment, which pushes us towards degenerative joint disease. So it's really impact load or repetitive load. If I think about, I'll just use a different discipline, I'll just use racing. So last week were the two-year-old prep races at Churchill Downs for the Derby horses. So the horses that you'll see in May, that one day, are already out there doing what? Repetitive load, repetitive load, repetitive load, over and over and over and over again. I do not underestimate the power of Mother Nature. I think she does a great job of keeping things in balance. Good husbandry, good nutrition, good shoeing, good footing, good training choices, all lead into good management of degenerative joint disease and understanding that that load is happening over and over and over again. A couple of things we need to understand when we're reading these articles and really kind of getting out there and really picking things up is joint anatomy. Everybody has seen the diagram of what is supposed to represent a fetlock, the cannon bone, the pastern. So what we're going to talk about is a diarthral joint. Di means two, arthral sort of means bone, two long bones coming together. Okay, cannon bone, pastern is still considered a long bone here. We have not a lot of musculature in this environment, but we have some very, very, very important stabilizing structures. Got skin, tendon, ligament. Think about the hocks and the knees down. Not a lot of muscle there. So I like range of motion, front to back, a tremendous amount of range of motion. If we take that fetlock and we flex it, we have a tremendous range of motion. How about medial to lateral? Who wants medial to lateral motion? Nobody. So the joint has to undergo all these varying planes to get through. Frontward to backward, constantly loading, unloading. There's also something here called the joint capsule. It inserts from one end of the long bone all the way down to the other. There used to be a term that you will see called capsulitis. I-T-I-S, itis, is anything with inflammation. If I'm out fixing a fence and I hit my thumb with a hammer, I have thumbitis, all right? I have inflammation of the thumb. Capsulitis, we really don't see that much anymore in the terminology because we're much better at catching the disease a lot earlier. And the tissue that we want to focus on is synovial lining or the synovial membrane. It's got a lot of jobs. I like to sort of think of the synovial lining kind of like the skin on a vitamin E capsule. The hyaluronic acid that's inside is that nice, squishy, lubricating fluid, and then that outside skin, sort of think of that as the synovial lining or the synovial membrane. This is very flaccid because as we get range of motion and we flex that limb, that synovial membrane has to come back, give. Then when the load is about to return to the ground, it has to recoil and come all the way back up together so that it doesn't get caught. Okay? That tissue is very, very elastic, opening and closing at a very, 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 very rapid rate when we start to think about it. We already talked about the HA, the hyaluronic acid. It has undergone what's known as a nomenclature change. It is now known as hyaluron in the literature. It's still HA to me. I will always call it HA. My clients call it HA, but when you're reading the literature, hyaluron is not a different, thicker, more viscous component. It's just that, again, from the human side, they've changed the name, so we've changed along with them. I find that most people end their kind of knowledge about joint disease at the end of HA. In other words, if I'm doing an intra-articular injection and I pop a needle inside of a joint and it comes out long, stringy, very viscous, I hear a sigh of relief. Oh, the joint is not too bad. If I stick a needle inside of a joint and it kind of drip, 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 drips out, the fluid is a lot thinner, not nearly as viscous, and they have a little bit of a panicked look on their face. But I'm going to say HA only plays a minor component in all of this, especially when it comes to repetitive load. And the two big players, the first one is articular cartilage. It is on each side of the long bone so that it meets and comes into contact with each other. So the articular cartilage on the cannon bone is going to come into contact with the articular cartilage on the pastern over and over and over again. The other one that we're finding out about, and really in about the past 5 years, we've made some monumental realizations about this tissue, is something called subchondral bone. And it lies right underneath articular cartilage. When I look at a radiograph, I am not just looking at the joint. I'm looking to where the capsule absolutely inserts to see if there's tugging on the bone, because I'll start to get some periosteal reaction that's happening. I'll look on the front edge for lipping, where these guys are knocking into each other. We know that if we start to have synovial membrane inflammation, we'll start to see wind puffs and wind galls and those sorts of things. So we're going to talk about using your powers of observation every day when you're working around your horse. So let's talk about the disease process itself. I've kind of already hammered home that trauma or repetitive load is something that leads us into early degenerative disease. I am a big stickler for this one. I am a confirmation nut. We'll forgive confirmation if performance is there. For the Europeans, even though a horse has had an outstanding career, they're very, very difficult to let those horses into the book sometimes. I think another thing that leads to degenerative joint disease is fatigue. I have overtraining and I have undertraining. I think that there is overtraining, guys staying out there much too long, those horses' repetitive load. We start to see a lot of fatigue. When they start to get to fatigue, they start leaning into that stride for a longer period of time and holding that load. That's typically why we would see a breakdown in a race at the end of the race. The horse is leaning into that limb, loading it in a stance phase for a much longer time than the limb was really adapted to do. I share that I have two trainers, two very successful hunter-jumper guys in New Jersey that I did their work. And the one trainer, same barn, there are about 50 horses there. One did the jumpers and one did the hunters. Whenever they called me, if it was trainer A, I always knew it was a soft tissue because he overtrained his horses so badly. Where the other guy, his horses were fat, happy, sassy. And when they called me, it was always a bony thing. It was a real aha moment for me about your training style absolutely goes into the way that the body and the athlete will respond. So if you start to see a habit or a trend inside of your barn, you may want to look at your training style a little bit further, or footing or other variables. Certainly age, I get the call a lot. Dr. Maxwell, I have a 27-year-old horse. He's perfectly sound. He's fine. He doesn't have degenerative joint disease. Do you think your drug would help him? I say, well, hard to believe that a 27-year-old horse does not have some form of degenerative joint disease, but no, I'm not looking at the horse. You should get your veterinarian to do a full assessment. Shoeing, another big caveat for mine. I'm not a big fan of long, low, and forward. I really like a shoe that fits well. Even if he tears it off in the paddock every other week, I would rather have a shoe that fit than to try to cut that off so that they're actually standing on the quarters. I don't need the shoe to end at the quarters of the hoof. I need it to support the full heel bulb because of all the structures that it's supporting going upward onto the limb. And then certainly there can be a disease, osteochondritis desiccans. It's a disease that we certainly see in young stock where there's incomplete ossification of the articular cartilage. But that's a much more in-depth talk. So let's talk a little bit, because you're getting Joint 101 here today. And I'm going to take you on a train a little bit up a hill, and then we're going to come down and coast through it. We are looking inside of the joint capsule again. So there's going to be cells that come up from the bone marrow to improve or try to wear and repair or keep up with the changes that happens on articular cartilage. That articular cartilage thins, gets thinner and thinner and thinner over time. As that happens, subchondral bone starts to thicken. It becomes sclerotic. It becomes less pliable. That is very important. That's when his stride is going away. He used to have such a nice, long, sweeping stride. Now he's kind of choppy, choppy, mincy, mincy, mincy. That's because the correlation between articular cartilage and subchondral bone has changed dramatically enough that he's changing the way that he's going. So again, on a radiograph, I'm looking at cartilage, I'm looking at density, I'm looking here, but I'm looking for the thickness underneath this bone. And that the reason that all of this has really opened up, it's MRI. We really, really, really have had a monumental amount of information flood into us regarding articular cartilage and subchondral bone. And we had really dramatically underestimated the importance of these two bones when it comes to adaptations. The next one that I want to introduce you to is something called proteoglycan complex. Everybody in this room knows proteoglycan complex. You just don't know that you know proteoglycan complex. So complex just means an accumulation of certain structures. And proteoglycan is something that's going to stand for glycosaminoglycans, or something called GAGs. When you think of glycosaminoglycan, I want you to think of big fat repeating sugar. End of it. So a GAG is a big fat repeating sugar. The three most important GAGs in the joint, you already know, are hyaluronic acid, chondroitin sulfate, and keratin sulfate. I would be surprised if somebody in this room had not heard those three terms. However, I probably have horse owners that have them on chondroitin sulfate and keratin sulfate. And I ask them, what does it do? Something in the joint. Well, what does it look like? What's a broken one look like? How does it repair itself? How does the body get rid of it? Is it stay there forever? Is it something that changes over? I'm going to help you kind of walk through that, because this is going to be a little bit of an aha moment. Again, our joint philosophy in our barn is now getting a little bit more intimate, okay? Proteoglycan complex. There's a cell that's responsible for making that. That's called a chondrocyte. The backbone is hyaluronic acid. If you remember from chemistry 101, sulfur has a negative charge. A negative does not want to be near what? Negative. Exactly. So it stays in this big sort of fanned out looking position. But when the load comes down onto the joint, all of this crushes, compresses, or what's called accommodates. Okay, there's a lot of water inside of here. I forgot to share that this is imbibed with about 75% water. You want to think of cartilage as a hyperhydrated gel. When the load comes down to that gel, all of this proteoglycan complex compresses. When I lift the load, these negative charges spit these back open again, draws the water in. Then the load goes down and they crush, and then they open up, down, up, down. It creates this pumping action that happens. In the morning, I've been sleeping horizontal all night. I get up and my first trip to the coffee pot, I'm pretty stiff. 10, 12, 15 strides, and then I start to warm up. What am I doing on my way to my coffee pot? I'm warming up my articular cartilage. I'm pumping, open, close, open, close. It starts to wrap around subchondral bone, and those two tissues start to work together to become more pliable. Who has a horse where you take him out and it takes him two or three turns around the ring to warm up out of it? Exactly. What's he warming up out of? Stiffness. What stiffness? Stiffness in articular cartilage and subchondral bone. That's kind of what's happening. It's happening to me, and I'm only 50, And it's happening to them at all varying stages. So a couple of key elements here. Sulfur, next to sulfur, is very important to keep that charge opening and going all the time, okay? There are actually enzymes. One of these is called an aggrecan. There are actually enzymes in inflammation, one called aggrecanase. ASE is an enzyme, and his job is to break that bond so that that aggrecan gets split and winds up going off out onto its own. So proteoglycan complex. And the thing that most resembles proteoglycan complex in 3D is Christmas garland. The long strand right down the middle is hyaluronic acid backbone, and all that little fluffy stuff that's coming off are my chondroitin sulfates and my keratin sulfates. So if I take that and I smoosh it together and all those charges push it back out and in and out and in and out, long, big, fluffy pieces are very, very efficient. Chondrocytes and proteoglycan are very fragile pieces of tissue. And Mother Nature, like I said, does a great job on her own, but with our high expectations of our athletes, we sort of drive them into a different direction. We're just about to the top of the sciencey hill, and we're going to coast on down. By missing proteoglycan complex, that big Christmas garland, I'm not holding near as much water up at that level as I was, so it begins to dry and become dehydrated, or what's called desiccated, okay? Finished, okay? As a horse trainer, I sort of waited for the changes to happen. I waited for a certain age group. I was going to the ring a lot in the 70s and the 80s, worked for some big names in the 90s. I worked for Conrad Homefeld and Joe Farges back in 1984, and they went to the games with a horse named Touch of Class. She cross-cantered the entire way through the Olympics. She never did one flying change. She wound up with a gold medal. But man, that mare had problems. Just to share, when we were in Florida that year with her, and the games were going to be in August, we put her into a walking program, and she walked almost 8 hours a day. So to keep the load off of her joints, but to keep the joints stimulated, rather than stall rest, she had weight on her. It was about a 120-pound woman, and she walked. And full bridle, full tack, every day, and walked and walked and walked. And she literally walked her way to the Olympics. But anyway, with age and progression, we drive cartilage into this thinning state. As good horsemen and veterinarians, we're trying to drive this cartilage back up into another direction. A horse doesn't walk out of a stall on his sixth birthday and go, yep, today's the day, he's got it. DJD, we knew it was coming. They toggle back and forth all the time. You give this guy 2 or 3 weeks off, maybe we change some footing inside of the ring. Adaptive changes that we can do in management to help this along.
You can hear part two of this segment on next week's episode. For more educational information, be sure to visit eTrack, the USDF's online learning center and resource for dressage and equine education at usdf.org. And don't forget that these podcasts are available for download from iTunes to your smartphone podcast apps. The USDF is your connection to the American dressage community.